Jackson pulled some splintered plywood over their hole, shivering like two wounded animals in the cold wind that moaned out of Laos. Jackson would occasionally shudder with stifled sobs. Mellis stared with his good eye into the blackness, enduring the pain in his leg and the throbbing in his other eye. He had tried reading the sea ration boxes earlier, and it felt awkward and uncomfortable. He consoled himself by imagining what he would look like in a Hathaway shirt ad. Then the sense of fear and loss coiled up from his stomach where it had lain waiting, and he wished fervently that he had taken Scheller's advice and tried to save the eye. He prayed. Mellis crawled out of the hole to check lines at 20:30. He returned at 22:30, dragging his leg. At 00:30, he started out again.
"I'll go, Lieutenant," Jackson said. "I can keep someone away just as good as you can."
Mellis didn't argue. He immediately dozed off with the radio against his cheek. Jackson crawled from beneath the plywood into a cold wind. He could sense that the clouds were higher, moving swiftly eastward, even though he couldn't see them. In the blackness around Matterhorn, the jungle lay breathing quietly after the convulsive fury of the morning. Jackson felt as if the jungle were resting, preparing to make its own assault on Matterhorn when these destructive insects left it to clean its own wounds. The jungle would slowly creep up the hill, covering it with new green skin, once again sheltering the exposed clay and rock, hiding the garbage thrown down its sides, softening the artificial lip of the LZ, and rounding Matterhorn smooth once again. Jackson squatted there, close to the solid sleeping earth, feeling its healing powers. Unexpected tears came to his eyes.
"Hamilton," he whispered, "I'm sorry. I'm so fucking sorry, man."
He was openly weeping now. He knew it was foolish to talk out loud to a dead person, but he felt that he somehow had to apologize to Hamilton for still being alive and so happy about it. Hamilton had wanted to get married and have children. Now he wouldn't, and Jackson would. The burst of crying passed. Jackson stayed there a little longer, feeling the damp wind on his wet face. He wiped his face with his hands, which were hot and cracked from dirt, dehydration, and infection. He couldn't shake off a persistent gnawing anxiety as he crawled away to check the lines. Why did Hamilton die and he live? When he finished checking all the holes, he didn't feel like going back to the hole under the plywood. Something compelled him to climb upward to the deserted LZ. When Jackson tripped the mine, the explosion jerked Mellis back to the darkness and the cold. At first he thought it might be someone from the CP group. Then he heard Jackson's frightened, wild cry.
"Help me! God help me! Please, someone help!"
Mellis slung the radio on his back and crawled toward Jackson's voice, whispering,
"No,"
over and over. He reached Jackson just after Fredrickson, who was holding Jackson down, trying to get hold of his thighs. Jackson was screaming.
"Help me hold the fucker down, Lieutenant," Fredrickson said. "God damn it, Jackson, stop moving!"
Mellis lay down over Jackson's heaving chest, whispering,
"You're going to be all right, Jackson. You're going to be all right."
"Scheller!"
Fredrickson shouted to the senior squid, who was already crawling through the blackness.
"I need some goddamned IV fluid and something to cut off these arteries."
Scheller appeared with a bottle and IV tubes as well as his kit. While Fredrickson was doing what he could to stanch the bleeding, Scheller jabbed a catheter into Jackson's arm and held the glass of fluid as high in the air as he could. Jackson calmed down, his terror and panic diminishing as the two corpsmen got his faltering system working again. Mellis glanced down Jackson's body. Fredrickson was working on pulp below Jackson's knees. There were no feet.
"You're going to be all right, Jackson,"
Mellis kept repeating.
"You're going to be all right."
Jackson moaned and passed out. Mellis didn't pray, but his mind once again soared above the landing zone, seeing all of I Corps below him, and went looking for something better than God. A good chopper pilot. At the MAG-39 airfield just outside Quang Tri, First Lieutenant Steve Small was losing at AC-DC to his co-pilot, Mike Nichols. It seemed to Small that the present game of AC-DC had never started and never ended. It was as much a part of life at MAG-39 as the sand, sweaty flight suits, 10-cent bourbon, gritty sheets, guilty masturbation fantasies, crappy movies, and underlying anxiety that the next flight was the one where the Gook 51 was going to rip a hole right up your anus and out of your mouth. Small's CH-46 waited in the dark, its twin rotor blades drooping with their own weight. Crew members dozed on canvas stretchers amid machine gun ammunition and boxes of IV fluid. Small's chest armor, hanging from his shoulders, seemed heavier than usual. Maybe he had overdone it at the O Club. On the other hand, maybe he hadn't drunk enough. He'd flown that damned bird so many hours it didn't make any difference if he flew it fucked up or not. The thing seemed to fly itself. Its whirling blades and sickening lunges entered his dreams at night, along with its beauty when it slipped off a mountaintop or slid into a perfect landing in a small zone, the grunts grinning at him, rushing up to get their goodies or staring dull-eyed in relief as they threw on board what remained of their friends. The ready room radio squawked, and the man on watch put down his hot rod magazine to answer it. Small and Nichols listened tensely. Small checked his watch. It was 0217. No hope of daylight. Big John Bravo again. One emergency. Matterhorn. Weather terrible. The same fuckers that had carved out that goddamn canary perch on Skycap. The same dumb sons of bitches he'd flat-headed over all of western Quang Tri province to take that crazy red-headed grunt lieutenant and his overloaded replacements up to the biggest shit sandwich he'd seen in almost 10 months of combat flying. And the bastards were still at it. Jesus fucking Christ, he thought. Then he wondered why the Christian deity was so much more satisfying as a swear word than the Jewish deity of his childhood. It had all started when he found out that Art Buchwald was in the 4th Marine Aircraft Wing in World War II. What was he fucking thinking? All this was running through his head as he and Nichols ran for the door. There was no question of not trying. Their running steps awoke the crew. Small immediately began going through startup procedures while Nichols radioed for artillery clearance so they wouldn't get shot out of the air on their way past the big Army 175s at VCB and the 8-inchers firing night missions out of Red Devil. The engines whined. The blades turned clumsily. Instruments glowed in front of the two pilots. Small taxied out onto the runway. The fuselage trembled. The roar increased to the point where only the radios inside their helmets could be heard. The bird moved forward in the darkness and lifted gently from the earth. Stray lights rapidly grew dim behind them in the mist, then disappeared. They were in total blackness, save for the dim green glow of the instrument panel. Small was sweating, but not from heat. It was going to be a pisser. He got a bearing from Nichols and settled in at 6,000 feet. Black clouds obscured the sky above him. Below, unseen but clear in his imagination from countless daylight missions, were the plains with their elephant grass, bamboo, and slow, sluggish rivers. Then came the mountains.
"Try and get Bravo up on their company push," Small told Nichols over the intercom.
He was straining to catch a glimpse of anything familiar, to let him know how close to the ground he was, how close to death.
"Big John Bravo, Big John Bravo, this is Chatterbox 1-8, over."
Silence. Maybe the stupid grunts didn't know that Group had changed the call from Magpie, standard operating procedure to keep Gook intelligence guessing. Small didn't like Chatterbox. It sounded too cute. He didn't feel cute.
"Big John Bravo, Big John Bravo, Chatterbox 1-8, over."
There was a burst of static.
"They must be able to hear us," Nichols said. "Too weak to reach us on their company push."
Small looked at a dog-eared card on a clipboard strapped to his leg. He dialed to the battalion frequency, knowing that the battalion operator would probably have the big aerial up.
"Big John Bravo, Chatterbox 1-8, over."
Relznik's voice, amplified by the 2-9-2 antenna, came out of the blackness into the helmets of the two pilots.
"Chatterbox, this is Big John Bravo. We got your Loco Coco. How you? Over."
Small smiled at hearing Loco Coco for loud and clear. That was new to him. Lemon and Coke last week. Lickety Clit 2 weeks before.
"I got you fine. I don't know where in hell you are. Over."
"We're on Matterhorn, sir. Over."
Small cursed under his breath. Goddamn kids on the fucking radios. Where was the goddamn fact man? He took a deep breath to control his temper and fear.
I know you're on Matterhorn Bravo. I mean, I can't see you. It's fucking dark up here. Turn on a goddamn light.
There was a long pause. A new voice came up on the radio. Chatterbox, this is Bravo 6. We've been taking mortar fire all day, and we're a little reluctant to light fires. Over. Well, I'm a little reluctant to fly fucking blind in the goddamn mountains, Small thought to himself. He knew Bravo had had the shit beat out of it lately.
What's your ceiling like there? And where's your FAC? Over.
There was another pause. Leave it to a fucking grunt to have no idea how high the clouds were. The answer was more like a question.
150 feet, Chatterbox? Over.
Fuck.
Inside the dimly lit bubble, the two pilots looked at each other. 150 feet at 100 miles an hour took less than a second. Fitch's voice came over the radio.
We got your sound, Chatterbox. You're to our Sierra Echo, bearing 140. Can you come up on the company freak? Over. Roger, see you there. Over.
Small immediately corrected the helicopter's direction and twisted knobs back to Bravo's frequency, clearing the battalionet for other traffic. They got back in contact again.
You give me a mark when I pass overhead, okay?
Small radioed.
How am I doing for course? Over.
Still to our Sierra Echo,
Fitch returned.
Keep coming. Over.
The bubble vibrated green and red in the darkness. Small pictured an imaginary Bravo 6, somewhere below him, in a muddy hole, straining to hear the faint lawnmower rattle that meant life or death for a wounded grunt. The radio spat out,
Mark!
Small banked immediately, but only saw blackness.
I didn't see a fucking thing, Bravo! Over!
Small radioed back, already straightening the bird to horizontal and coming back toward the place where he had heard, Mark! All the while watching his altimeter and his roll and pitch indicator.
How high above you do you think we were? Over.
Again the long pause. Again the tentative answer.
600 feet. Over.
We got any other fucking mountains to worry about around here? Small snapped to Nichols. Nichols answered immediately.
Dong Sam Wei at 5,100 feet, about 2 clicks to the northeast. Other than that, Matterhorn's about it for 4 clicks.
Small muttered under his breath. He asked the grunts to try artillery illumination rounds. They lit up only the fog.
What the fuck's wrong with your emergency case, Bravo? Over,
Small asked, almost absently, as he was trying to think what to do.
He's got both his legs blown off. Over.
Why even bother?
I can't find you fuckers without any lights on the LZ. Isn't there some way you can hide some? Over.
Again the silence.
We could put some heat tabs and helmets. Over.
Jesus, a fucking grunt that could think. A fucking miracle.
Good. Put them in a 20-meter circle. You got it? 10 meters radius. Exactly. Otherwise, I won't know how far above the fucking thing I am. Over.
There was a wait. Then Bravo 6 came up again.
Chatterbox, it'll have to be 13.5 meters diameter. The rest of the area is mined, and we can't guarantee it.
There was a pause and a blip of static as Fitch let up on the key. Then he was back.
But if you want to risk it, we'll risk making the circle. Over.
Small switched over to the intercom and spoke to Nichols.
Mind? Can you believe this fucking shit? They want me to hit the top of a fucking mountain in the dark, in the fucking fog, and the goddamned LZ is mined? And all this to get some poor bastard that probably would rather be dead anyway. At least I would.
Jesus Christ, both fucking legs.
Better than both balls.
I ain't so sure. What's he gonna do back home? Fuck cantaloupes for the rest of his life?
Small was trying to imagine what 13.5 meters would look like, compared with 20, and trying to get that into his head so if he did see it, he could guess how high above the LZ he was.
Okay, Bravo, don't risk the mines, but get the fucking circle made. I don't have all night. And when I say Papa Willie Pete, I don't care if they mortar the fuck out of you, you Papa goddamn Willie Pete. You got one? Over.
Bravo 6 said they did. They collected heat tabs from all over the company and placed their helmets in a circle around Jackson and the two corpsmen. When the pilot gave the word, China and Conman ran from helmet to helmet with cigarette lighters, igniting the heat tabs. A blue circle of light, ghostly in the fog, grew around Jackson, the helmets hiding the flickering blue flame from all directions except directly above. The huge helicopter rushed in just a few feet above their heads. The rotor wash tipped over two of the helmets, and dark figures rushed to hide the two heat tabs, throwing them back in with bare hands. Mellis heard the pilot mutter over the radio. "Jesus Christ, Bravo, I'm right on top of you fuckers. Okay, coming around. Get that man ready. I got your heat tabs. Over." "Can you believe this, Nichols?" Small said, switching to the intercom. "I actually said, I got your heat tabs. Holy shit," he thought to himself. 13.5 meters. "Okay, Bravo, coming around," he radioed. "You pop that Willy Pete when I tell you. Over." Small looked over his shoulder into the blackness behind the chopper, but the dim circle was lost in the clouds again. Totally blind, he felt more than he piloted. The big bird around to come at the LZ again, keeping that faint picture of glowing blue in his mind. He straightened the chopper out slowly and came back down to the same altimeter reading. He changed the pitch and attitude. The helicopter roared alone in the blackness. Suddenly, like a marsh ghost, a quavering blue oblong appeared, moving fast, too fast, changing to a circle, changing too fucking fast, too fucking fast. "Now, goddammit, now!" Small yelled. "Now!" Fitch shouted, and Palak popped the spoon on the white phosphorus grenade and threw it into the zone. Sudden, brilliant white lights stabbed at the men's eyes. The huge, whirling black mass crashed into the zone with an anguished screech of buckling metal. The front wheels gave way and the bird lurched sideways, nosing in, pivoting on the buckled wheels, twisted by the torque of its blades. Then it lurched sideways and came to a stop, its tailgate jammed. The crew chief came crawling out over the barrel of a 50-caliber machine gun, shouting. The litter bearers hoisted Jackson in through the narrow opening, handing the plasma bottle to the side gunner. Fredrickson and Scheller, seeing Jackson safely inside, scrambled back and dropped to the mud as the blades of the chopper gained speed. Fredrickson picked up two bloody objects and threw them through the side opening. Jackson's boots. His feet still in them. Then the mortar shells started homing in on the burning phosphorus. The helicopter skimmed across the landing zone and disappeared, falling downhill into the darkness. "Get off the top of the fucking hill!" Fitch shouted unnecessarily. Everyone was running for cover. Conman tried to extinguish the burning phosphorus. It broke into smaller pieces, and he screamed in pain when one of them burned a tiny hole into his leg. It went through the muscle and didn't stop until it reached the bone. Mellis spent the rest of the night trying to understand why Jackson had lost both legs while he himself seemed to bounce from near miss to near miss. He felt that somehow he had cheated. Then he laughed softly. What was he supposed to do, stand up and get blown away to make things up to the dead and the maimed? He thought of the jungle, already regrowing around him to cover the scars they had created. He thought of the tiger, killing to eat. Was that evil? And ants. They killed. No, the jungle wasn't evil. It was indifferent. So, too, was the world. Evil, then, must be the negation of something man had added to the world. Ultimately, it was caring about something that made the world liable to evil. Caring. And then the caring gets torn asunder. Everybody dies. But not everybody cares. It occurred to Mellis that he could create the possibility of good or evil through caring. He could nullify the indifferent world. But in so doing, he opened himself up to the pain of watching it get blown away. His killing that day would not have been evil if the dead soldiers hadn't been loved by mothers, sisters, friends, wives. Mellis understood that in destroying the fabric that linked those people, he had participated in evil, but this evil had hurt him as well. He also understood that his participation in evil was a result of being human. Being human was the best he could do. Without man, there would be no evil. But there was also no good, nothing moral built over the world of fact. Humans were responsible for it all. He laughed at the cosmic joke, but he felt heartsick. The next morning, Mellis crawled from his hole to make his round of the perimeter. He went from hole to hole, kidding, trying to lighten everyone up. He poked fun at Conman for trying to handle burning phosphorus with his bare hands. Conman flipped him the bird and looked pleased that Mellis was acknowledging his sacrifice. Some of the kids began to open sea rations with the tiny can openers that hung with their dog tags. Others brewed coffee. Several were digging a hole to shit in away from the lines. All around Malus, the ridges and peaks stood clearly against the lightening sky. The jungle in the valley below him was no different from when he'd first arrived, silent, gray-green, at once ancient and ageless. But it was no longer a mystery. It contained rivers that he'd waded across and fought in. There were also hilltops whose approaches and slightest contours he knew intimately, and bamboo patches, beaten down and forced back, already starting to rise again. And there was a trail, now beginning to grow over, soon to disappear. It was another ordinary day in the world of fact. But it was different because the mystery had been slightly penetrated and Malus saw things differently. He stopped at the CP to find out about Jackson. Fitch said he was still alive. Four phantoms roared across the top of the hill, shattering the dawn with noise, just as artillery fire erupted in the valley to the northwest. "That's the prep for speeding home Kilo," Fitch murmured to no one in particular. Soon, four CH-46s circled into the valley to the north. Everyone in the CP group listened in on Kilo's frequency as the lead platoon commander reported a cool zone.
"The gooks are making fucking hat," Palak announced.
Everyone smiled. Malus guessed, however, that Kilo's job would be to sit astride the escape routes. They'd be busy soon enough. Hawk joined them, and Fitch passed his coffee around the circle. They decided to build a new LZ out of sight of the NVA observers, between Matterhorn and Helicopter Hill, to evacuate the walking wounded like Malus. Malus gave Conman the platoon and was helped down the hill to the new zone, where he collapsed. He lay there semi-conscious. Anne floated through his mind, and he awoke to feel the hidden sun on his face, or the cool mist, and to an emptiness and a longing for her unlike any he'd ever felt. But he knew it was useless to think of getting back together, and that was months in the future anyway. There were white girls in Sydney. Round eyes. Maybe he'd go to the outback. A quiet farm with sheep. Maybe he'd fall in love there. Maybe he'd save his eye. Everything seemed to be part of a cycle as he stared into the gray nothingness above him, hearing the wash of distant waves on a warm beach, feeling the sun pulling his body upward like evaporating rain. Then he remembered Vancouver's sword, still in the CP bunker on Helicopter Hill. He got two of the walking wounded to come with him for security. Stevens was on watch in the little bunker. A work party was just finishing a larger bunker for the CP group. Malus could see the colonel and the three talking with Bainford, looking at something off to the north, their maps out. He nodded to Stevens in the gloom, crawled over to the corner, and pulled out the sword.
"That yours, Malus?"
Stevens asked in amazement. Malus eyed him for a long moment. "I don't know," he finally said. "I really don't know."
"Yeah, okay," Stevens said. "You guys did a hell of a job yesterday."
Looking at Stevens with one eye made Malus aware that he had taken seeing for granted. Now, this way, he saw Stevens differently from before. He couldn't get mad at Stevens for the comment. Stevens was just Stevens, a cog in the machinery trying to be nice. And Malus was just Malus, another cog, deciding not to get angry. He didn't much like being a cog, but there it was. He smiled at his silent conversation.
"Thanks,"
Malus said. He returned to the new LZ and fell asleep with the sword beside him. Someone was kicking his boot. Malus opened his good eye. He was flooded with ugly anger at being disturbed. It was McCarthy. Alpha Company was winding through the small landing zone.
"Wake up, you silly fucker," McCarthy said. "It took me forever to find you with that goddamn bandage wrapped around your face."
Malus, smiling, reached a hand up to McCarthy. McCarthy's radio operator was smoking impatiently.
"Where the fuck you going?"
Malus asked.
"West. 224 set up a blocking position right on the Z at the Laos end of the valley. We'll be the hammer. Charlie Company's kicking off to our north right now. They're pulling you guys out this afternoon."
He paused.
"You guys had a rough time, didn't you?"
"Yeah," Malus agreed.
"Nothing unusual, though. Light casualties, I believe it's called, back in the world.
All you have to do is report it as a battalion action and the percentage lost thins to nothing. Who's going to hold Matterhorn?
Why should you care? You'll be skating on board the sanctuary, dazzling round-eyed nurses. Maybe we'll get in another mystery tour when this fucking op's over.
Who's holding fucking Matterhorn?
Mallis demanded, rising to his elbows, his good eye beginning to spasm. McCarthy shrugged.
No one, he said.
Mallis sank back to the ground and lay looking at the sky.
No one.
Finally he spoke.
Be careful, Mac.
Don't worry about me, McCarthy said.
Mallis looked at him. They both knew McCarthy was going into a fight that afternoon, the same day Mallis was leaving it all. It was another cycle, another wearying, convulsive rhythm, and if it wasn't Mallis, it was McCarthy. And if not McCarthy, someone like McCarthy, forever and forever, like an image in facing mirrors in a barber shop, deeper and deeper, smaller and smaller, curving with time and distance away into the unknown, but always repeating, always the same. Mallis thought that if he could smash one of those mirrors, then this agony would stop and he'd be left alone to dream. But the mirrors were only thoughts, illusions. Reality was McCarthy, standing above him, a friendly face, his radio man impatient to get going because they'd have to hump extra fast to catch up with the rest of the platoon.
Good luck, Mallis said.
McCarthy waved and trudged after his radio operator. He turned and waved again. Mallis kept thinking, don't get killed, damn you. Don't let yourself get killed.
Chapter 20 The medevac helicopter flew eastward. It flashed across a white beach and then out over the South China Sea. Eventually, a white ship with large red crosses on its superstructure and hull appeared below. The chopper tilted back, its blades pounding the air, and set down on the deck. Corman ran inside and hauled the wounded out on stretchers. A nurse in fatigues was holding a clipboard looking at medevac tags and wounds. She was rapidly sorting the wounded into groups. The most severely wounded were being shoved to the side as the less wounded were stripped of weapons, boots, and clothes and rushed into the interior of the ship. The nurse grabbed for Mellis's tag, not really looking at him.
I'm all right, he said. Those guys over there are a lot worse off than I am.
You let me run triage, Marine.
She looked up at his bandages. She had a coarse red face, small eyes that seemed sleep-deprived, and heavy eyebrows. She wore her hair in two short, stiff pigtails.
Most likely to survive go first, she said.
Mallis realized that the idea was to maximize the number of men who could return to combat.
What's this?
She asked, pointing at Vancouver's sword. It's a friend of mine's.
All weapons, Marine,
she said, motioning for the sword. I'm a lieutenant.
Sorry,
came the sarcastic reply.
Look, lieutenant, I'm busy. All weapons, even stupid souvenirs.
The fuck it's a souvenir?
What did you say, Marine? You know you're talking to a lieutenant in the United States Navy, don't you?
That rank was the equivalent of a Marine captain.
Yes, ma'am.
Mallis gave her a sloppy, non-regulation salute, his hand curved over limply. How do I know I'll get it back? He asked, still holding the salute, waiting for her to return it. The nurse glared at him. Then she shouted over her shoulder,
Bell, take this man's weapon.
I told you.
You obey orders, Lieutenant, or I'll have your ass on report.
She moved off to the next man, reading his medevac tag, writing on her clipboard. Bell, a hospital corpsman, came over and took the sword. He looked at it appraisingly.
How do I know I'll get it back? Mallis asked again.
You pick it up when you get orders back ashore, sir.
I want a receipt.
Sir, you're holding up the process. We got 24th Marines in the shit, and
I'm in the 24th Marines. I want a fucking receipt.
We don't have any receipt forms for swords, Lieutenant. It'll go with the rifles. It'll be all right. I've had three of my men pay for their goddamn rifles because some fucker in the Navy sold them to the gooks. I want a receipt and I want it now.
Bell looked around for help. He spotted the nurse and went over to her. Mallis saw her set her lips tight, then say something to Bell. Bell returned. You'll have to wait, sir. The lieutenant says she's busy. When the last stretcher disappeared inside the ship, the nurse walked over toward Mellis, holding herself rigid.
Now what's the problem, lieutenant?
Ma'am, the lieutenant would like a receipt for the lieutenant's weapon, ma'am.
A receipt, I see.
She looked down at her clipboard.
Mellis, 2nd Lieutenant, Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 24th Marine Regiment, correct?
Yes, ma'am, Mellis replied.
I'm going to issue you a direct order, 2nd Lieutenant Mellis, with HM1 Bell as a witness. If the order isn't obeyed, I'm going to place you under arrest for disobeying a direct order. Is that perfectly clear?
Yes, ma'am, Mellis said tightly.
Lieutenant Mellis, give your weapon, that sword, to HM1 Bell and get your ass down to the officer's ward. If you're not moving in 10 seconds, I'm placing you under arrest. As it is, I'm putting you on report for disrupting triage.
Mellis knew when the machinery had him. He gave Bell the sword. In the officer's ward, another corpsman collected Mellis's reeking uniform, but Mellis wouldn't let him take the boots. He tied them to the end of the bed and glared at the corpsman. When he felt the boots were safe, he found a basin, filled it with warm water, and with a deep sigh put both feet into it. Sometime later, he was brought back to reality by the voice of another corpsman.
"Debriding, Lieutenant," he said.
Mellis reluctantly removed his feet from the basin. They put him on a gurney and wheeled him deeper inside the ship. There they gave him a local anesthetic, and he watched them pick metal, dirt, and cloth from his legs, snip off dead flesh, then clean and rebandage the shrapnel wounds.
"The rest will come out on its own," the surgeon said, already looking at the next problem on the list, wiping his hands.
A corpsman wheeled Mellis back to his bed. He had to wake Mellis up to get him into it. He jerked awake, his heart pounding upon hearing his name. He took a gulp of air and searched frantically for danger with his good eye. A nurse with red hair, whose name tag read Elskid, K.E., was standing over him. Like the triage nurse, she wore the twin bars of a Navy lieutenant. She was curt.
"You're due in the operating room in 5 minutes, Lieutenant."
She looked at his bandaged legs.
"Can you walk, or do you need help?"
"Whatever's efficient," Mellis answered. He crawled out of the bed and walked, his legs stiff. She led the way down the passage, turning occasionally to see how far behind he was. Mellis watched her every move, noticing her hips and the outline of her bra strap beneath the crisp white synthetic material of her dress. He longed to catch up to her and touch her, make contact with someone soft, someone who smelled clean and fresh, someone warm. He wanted to talk to someone who knew how he felt, who could talk to the lost, lonely part of him. He wanted a woman. The nurse directed two corpsmen to arrange Mellis on an operating table. She wouldn't look him in the eye. Mellis regretted being sent to this place, where his sudden flood of longing had no possibility of fulfillment. "She thinks all I want to do is stick it in her," he thought bitterly. "Of course I do, but there's so much more." He laughed aloud.
"What's so funny?" one of the corpsmen asked, moving a huge machine that hung from a track overhead.
He positioned it carefully over Mellis's face. Between the emotion and the response, the desire and the spasm falls the shadow, Mellis said. He attempted a smile. The red-haired nurse turned to look at him intently. They held him down by the shoulders, and an older doctor came in. He peered into Mellis's eye and injected a local anesthetic next to it. The nurse washed the eye, cleaning out the dirt and powder that had mixed with the ointment that Fredrickson had shoved into it. A piece of shrapnel had laid open Mellis's eyelid. Another piece had gone into the skin just above the bridge of his nose, stopping against the skull. Mellis was tense with fear of what was coming. He looked up at a large black machine on tracks above him. It had large, thick glass lenses and a stainless steel needle about 6 inches long that narrowed to a very fine point. The machine started to glow through the lenses, which magnified the doctor's eyes, peering back at him. Then the lenses covered the brilliant light, and the light seemed to penetrate Mellis's brain. The steel needle came out of the haze of light, and the doctor moved dials that moved the needle. The red-headed nurse's hands pressed down on Mellis's forehead and chest. The needle went into Mellis's eye. He held on to the gurney and tried not to scream. Bit by bit, The chips and flakes of the defective hand grenade were picked from Ellis's eye. Then the surgeon put two stitches in the eyelid. "You're incredibly lucky, Lieutenant," the doctor said. He was already pulling off his mask. Two of those slivers were just microns from severing the optic nerve. "You'd have lost your eye." He pushed the machine back. "You won't see normally for a week or so. Keep a patch on it for a while, but you'll be able to return to your unit in about a week." He turned and began washing his hands. Mellis felt as if he'd just been notified of his own hanging. He was wheeled back and he slept. When Mellis awoke, he climbed out of the stiff sheets and hobbled to the passageway. The cold steel beneath his feet vibrated from the ship's engines. He hailed a passing corpsman and asked where the enlisted men were. He was pointed in the right direction and limped off. He found Jackson in a ward with about a dozen other wounded Marines, all hooked up to IV bottles. Jackson was awake, staring at the wall, propped up against the headboard with a blanket over his legs. There were no bumps at the end of the blanket. Mellis suddenly didn't want Jackson to see him. He wanted to walk away and blot Jackson from his mind. A corpsman came up to Mellis. "Can I help you, Lieutenant," Mellis finished for him. "I'd like to see one of my men." "Sir, we're not supposed to have visitors except between 1400 and 1600 hours. These guys are still pretty critical." Mellis looked at the corpsman. "Doc, he was my radio man." "If one of the fucking nurses comes in, I ain't covering for you," the man said and stepped aside. Mellis approached the bed. Jackson turned his head slightly, then looked away. "Hi, Jackson. How you doing?" "How the fuck you think?" Mellis took a breath and nodded his head. He didn't know what to say. It was clear that Jackson didn't want to see him. "Look, Lieutenant, just get the fuck out of here." Other Marines, who'd been half-listening from nearby beds, went back to reading or fiddling with the tie strings on their light blue pajamas. Mellis, also in pajamas, standing alone, felt suddenly naked. He seemed to be a petitioner at Jackson's stumps. "Jackson." Jackson turned his head again, looking coolly at Mellis. "Jackson, I..." Mellis tried to keep some dignity, not wanting to break down in front of everyone. "Jackson, I'm sorry it happened to you." Jackson turned back to the bulkhead. Then his lips started to quiver. "I lost my legs," he said, his voice shaking. He started to moan. "I lost my legs." He turned to Mellis. "Who's gonna fuck someone with no legs?" His voice rose and he broke down completely. "Who's gonna fuck a goddamn watermelon?" Mellis backed away a couple of steps, shaking his head, feeling he'd done something wrong for still being whole, for having collapsed, for letting Jackson do the hole checks. He wanted forgiveness, but there was none. Jackson was now thrashing back and forth, shouting. Corman rushed to hold him down and one shot a needle into his thigh. "You better get out of here, Lieutenant," the corpsman said. Mellis limped into the passageway. He listened to Jackson's muffled screaming until the drug took effect. Then he walked slowly back to the officer's ward. He slept and slept, waking up only for meals. When he finally had enough courage to visit Jackson again, he found someone else in the bed. Jackson had been flown to Japan. Between bandage changes, Mellis took long showers, ignoring the Navy's plea to take short ones. Then he slept some more. He occasionally saw the nurse from triage. They studiously avoided each other. He also saw the red-haired nurse coming into and out of the ward. He couldn't help watching her. To his displeasure, she seemed to be on good terms with the triage nurse. He tried to engage the red-haired nurse in conversation, but it was clear that she was on duty and had little time for it. She was polite and would occasionally give him a warm smile after checking on his eye. Soon they were having short conversations. He found out she, too, was from a small town, but in New Hampshire, and that they both used to like to pick blackberries. Although he was grateful for the brief conversations, what he wanted was to have her enfold him in her arms and hold him so tightly that it would be as if they had crawled inside each other. It wasn't to be. Within a couple of days, his wounds were no longer bleeding, and he was asked if he wanted to eat his meals in the officer's mess. He accepted. He walked hesitantly into the polished wooden interior wearing his old boots, fresh jungle utilities, and a gold second lieutenant's bar on one collar. Filipino messmen were putting the final touches on tablecloths. The tables were set with gleaming silver and white china. Mavis looked down at his scarred boots against the carpeted deck. One of the Filipinos motioned him toward a table for eight with four lighted candles as a centerpiece. He sat down. The chairs around the table filled with nurses, seven in all. Melis's heart hammered with joy at sitting next to these women. He tried to contain his excitement by rubbing his hands over the tablecloth. Several of the nurses tried to talk with him, but he couldn't respond intelligently. He was struck dumb. All he could do was stuff food in his mouth, look at them, and laugh. They were talking about commissaries in Manila and Sasebo, and about leaves in Taipei or Kuala Lumpur. Some made innuendos about male officers while the others giggled. Melis wanted to touch them. He wanted to reach out across the table and put his hand over their hearts and on their breasts. He wanted to put his head on their shoulders, smell their skin, and absorb their femininity. But they were older than he was, and they outranked him. They were also uncomfortable, assuming that he was horny. This was true, but it was not the whole story. Eventually their talk among themselves became less awkward, eddying around and over him, ignoring the problems and opportunities caused by the fact that they were women and he was a man. Finally they made their excuses and left Melis alone. The Filipino stewards cleared the tables. One brought him fresh coffee. He saw someone getting up from a chair across the room. It was the red-haired nurse. She seemed to hesitate, then walked over to Melis's table. "Mind if I sit down?" she asked. "Please do," Melis answered. He tried to think of a joke about the empty chairs around him, but couldn't. "How's the eye?" She sat down and leaned closer to him, inspecting the bandage. "Okay." "You like coffee, huh?" she asked. She smiled warmly. She had let down her hair from where it usually sat on the top of her head. It reached almost to her shoulders. Melis opened up like a flower. He found himself telling her every detail of how to make coffee with C4 explosives. They both talked about home, about growing up in small towns. She kidded him about paraphrasing Eliot just before the eye operation, but then she said, "Somehow I felt that I was the shadow." Melis cleared his throat and scraped his boots on the rug beneath his chair. "Well, not exactly. I mean, you were part of it. You really want to know?" "Sure." She smiled as if to say, "We're all grown-ups here." "Out in the bush," he said. "It's first the bang, and then the whimper. Then you end up here, and it's all whimper and no bang." He immediately regretted this attempt at being clever. "Not so funny," she said. "You're right," Melis said. "Sorry." He paused. "I just get tired of being politely treated like a sex offender." "You think we don't get tired of every kid that comes mooning in here out of the jungle desperate for it?" "It being sex." "I didn't think it was necessary for me to spell it out for you." "No, I can spell real good. Listen, S-E-X, right?" She smiled sarcastically. "Clever." "Yeah, clever." He looked at his coffee mug. "It's what every red-blooded American tiger wants, isn't it?" He cocked his head, looking at her. He saw Williams slung from a pole. "It's only natural, right?" "Sure," the nurse said, not unkindly. The calm, kind way she said, "sure," made Melis realize he was talking with an actual human being who cared. It diffused his anger at being perceived as a threat, and at his own failure to tell her that he just wanted to make friends. He stared at his mug. She sat back and looked at him somewhat quizzically. "They know they can't have SEX because enlisted men don't fuck officers," Melis said. "Maybe all they want is someone to be a woman around them instead of fake men with fake men talk.
They just want a real woman to smile at them and talk to them as though they were real people instead of animals.
You'd see it differently if you were in our shoes, she said.
And you'd see it differently if you were in ours, Malice replied.
There it is,
she said. She looked him in the eye and smiled, warmly.
Look, I wasn't trying to be prissy.
He noticed that her own eyes were green. Malice could see that she was trying to connect with him. He melted and smiled back.
You've got to understand what we do here, she said.
She started to reach her hand toward him on the table, but checked it and put both hands on her coffee cup instead.
We fix weapons.
She shrugged.
Right now, you're a broken guidance system for 40 rifles, 3 machine guns, a bunch of mortars, several artillery batteries, 3 calibers of naval guns, and 4 kinds of attack aircraft. Our job is to get you fixed and back in action as fast as we can.
I know. I just don't feel very much like a weapon right now.
How often do you think I feel like a mechanic?
She shot back. Then she softened.
It's not why I became a nurse.
She put her palms to the sides of her forehead and rested her elbows on the table.
I do get so tired of it all.
She looked up at him, no longer a Navy nurse, just an exhausted young woman.
There's too many kids coming on board, she finally said. They're lonesome. They're in pain. They're scared of dying.
She paused.
We can only patch the bodies. For all the other...
She searched for a word.
Stuff. Well, we try to keep our distance. It isn't easy.
There it is, Melis said. She was stirring up all the feelings he'd had when the meal started. He was afraid he'd say something wrong and she would leave, so he said nothing. She broke the silence.
They're sending you back to the bush, aren't they?
Melis nodded. She sighed.
It's like, I do my job well, and the result is sending you back to combat.
Kind of a bind.
Nothing like going back to the bush.
Melis smiled at her again. He felt understood. He felt that he could talk with her. It's different this time, he said. I know what I'm in for. He swallowed, looked up, and then exhaled briefly.
I'm afraid to go back.
He looked at her, worried that he may have overstepped a boundary, revealed too much. He ran his open palm over his unbandaged eye, shutting out the soft light of the wardroom. Images flooded in, stiff, twisted bodies, the terror on Jacobs's face, a leg pumping blood. Remember that feeling you got picking blackberries? He asked. You know, with friends and maybe somebody's grandmother who's come along and she's going to make pie when you get home, and the air's so warm it's like Mother Nature is baking bread. She nodded, smiling.
I remember.
There used to be a great patch, Melis continued, near the garbage dump of this little logging town where I grew up. He smoothed the tablecloth. She waited for him to continue. It's like a car suddenly roars down on you with 6 beefy guys in it. You stand there next to this old, kind woman with your berry bucket in your hand, and you're suddenly a little scared. All the guys have been drinking. Their faces are covered with masks. They have rifles. One takes the berry buckets and throws them down on the side of the road. They shove you around. Then they take you to the dump, laughing a little, as if they're expecting some fun. You're instructed that you're all going to play a game. Here's the rules. Melis carefully pressed a butter knife into the white tablecloth. The men, that is, the boys, have to crawl through the dump from one end to the other. Whenever we come across a can whose lid we cannot see, we must pick it up and show it to the men with the rifles. If the can turns out to be empty, we can continue. If it turns up unopened, then we get killed. We get down in the garbage. The dump always has a fire smoldering. The smoke makes you puke and cough. The old grandma's job consists of bringing water to any of us who come up with a pleasing or clever way of revealing the can.
We even get ribbons if we're particularly clever. Of course, if we refuse to pick up any cans, then we have to stay crawling in the garbage forever, or at least until the strange men get tired of their fucking game. Mellis had to force the last sentences out between clenched teeth. He was bending the butter knife against the table, his knuckles white. And one by fucking one, the knife bent slowly. The guys you picked berries with get killed. And you just keep being clever. He rocked forward with each word. And the game goes on and on and on. He looked up at her, the knife in his hand. The same rage that had caused him to whip out his K-bar and slash plants rose inside him. He wanted to lash out and cause pain. He pushed the knife's point into the tablecloth and with both hands bent the blade 90 degrees. This clearly scared her. She rose.
"I'm sorry, Lieutenant," she said. "Maybe I..."
She started to say something more but stopped. Mellis was bewildered at what had just happened.
"I'm the one who should say sorry," he said.
He nervously placed the bent knife next to a plate, wanting it out of his hand. It looked very odd there.
"It just spills out. I feel really stupid."
She reached across the table and put her hand on his.
"Don't be hard on yourself. It might be what gets you through."
She pressed his hand quickly a couple of times.
"God knows we all need something."
She looked at him for a moment.
"You take care of yourself out there."
Then she walked rapidly through the hatch. Mellis was alone with his pounding heart and his inexplicable rage. He knew that he'd destroyed the one chance he had to talk with the one woman who'd offered him what all the others were afraid to give. He wanted to run to her, grab her, talk with her about love and friendship. Instead, he grabbed a handful of the polished silverware from the white tablecloth and hurled it against one of the plushly upholstered couches that lined the bulkhead. A Filipino messman stuck his head out from the swinging doors of the galley. Seeing Mellis standing there, fighting for control, he quickly pulled back inside. Mellis finished his coffee in silence. He could see his reflection in the polished wood paneling. It was obscure, a little distorted, but it was him. As he was now, alone. Mellis wanted off the hospital ship. Mellis was afraid to go back to the bush. Mellis had no place to go. His orders arrived in the morning. He was to return to his unit by 2000 hours the next day. So, with the arrival of this mimeographed sheet with his name on it, his feet had touched the ground. Time flooded back into his life like an unexpected but inevitable tide. He'd been on the ship 5 days. He set out to get back his rifle and Vancouver's sword. The sailor at the weapons locker looked bored. His weapon? His M16? It must have been sent on to 5th Marine Division. He put his on the list. A sword? No idea. They don't do swords here. They're not considered weapons. Mellis raged. The sailor sympathized. Mellis demanded to see someone. The sailor turned him over to the chief. The chief turned him over to the supply officer. The supply officer called up the records from the files. The records showed no sword. "Don't worry, it's probably gone to 5th Marine Division with the rifles. Did he have a receipt? Here, fill in this missing equipment form. After all, it is a weapon." Mellis returned to the ward, dejected, feeling powerless. At dinner that night, he was subdued. Everyone at the table knew he was going back to the bush the next morning. He would soon cease to be a problem. Everyone was polite. The red-haired nurse wasn't there. Around midnight, Mellis gingerly pulled his clothes on over the bandages and went to look for her. He stepped into the faintly trembling steel passageway. The gradual swell of the South China Sea, along with the vibration of the engines, came up through the soles of his boots. He headed into the interior of the ship, through a labyrinth of passageways, down ladders that led to unknown spaces. During the past few days, Just as he'd watched girls disappear down strange streets and into unknown houses in high school, he'd watched where the nurses disappeared to when they went off duty. Also, he remembered that the red-haired nurse was Lieutenant K.E. Elskid. Now, in the heat and stillness of the echoing decks and passageways lit by dim red lights, Mellis quietly worked his way closer to the center of Officer's Country. He knew that the area where the nurses lived was off-limits to him. Nevertheless, he nervously pushed ahead. A corpsman and then a sailor passed him. Both looked at him but said nothing because he was an officer. Mellis continued down the passageways. His boots, pliable from hours in water, whispered softly against the metal beneath them. He turned a corner in the passageway and went by an open door. Inside he glimpsed an older, gray-haired officer bent over a small desk. With a start, Mellis realized that this was the captain of the ship. He hurried by and worked through a bewildering maze of turns, not certain where he was, trusting to instinct that he'd eventually find Lieutenant Elskid's quarters with her name over the hatch. Eventually he did. His heart was thumping in his throat. If she reacted badly, he would be in serious trouble. He looked up and down the empty passageway, swallowed, then knocked. After a moment there was a muffled question to someone else, then a louder, "Who is it?" Mellis didn't know how to answer. He'd never actually told her his name. Would she remember it from the operating room? "Who is it?" a second, harsher voice repeated. "It's me." Mellis felt lame. "The Marine Lieutenant." He paused, then quickly added, "T.S. Eliot." There was a muffled, annoyed, "Who?" from the second voice, then a responding, "It's okay, I know him." There was a pause. "I'm afraid you do, too." The door opened. Lieutenant Elskid, clutching a white terrycloth bathrobe around her, peered out.
"What in the world are you doing here?"
she whispered.
"I gotta talk to you about something."
"What?"
she whispered.
"You're going to get in real trouble. Let me in, then."
She tightened her grip on the robe, closing it more firmly.
"Please?"
Mellis whispered. He looked at her pleadingly.
"It's not what you think. I need help."
He saw her fingers relax slightly.
"I need someone who knows the machinery around here. I mean the social machinery."
She paused a moment.
"Okay."
She opened the hatch. "God, the things I do for my country." Mellis slipped in. She turned on a desk lamp.
"Sorry, Kendra,"
she said. Mellis looked over to see the nurse from triage on the lower bunk. She looked back, her jaw tight.
"I believe you two know each other,"
Lieutenant Elskid said impishly.
"Second Lieutenant Mellis, United States Marine Corps."
She nodded her head slightly toward Mellis.
"Reserve, correct?"
She had a hint of a smile.
"Meet Lieutenant Dunn, United States Navy."
She pulled a chair out from under the desk.
"Now that you've been introduced, maybe you could both relax."
She sat down and pulled her bathrobe tighter around her knees. She leaned back and put her hands in the bathrobe pockets, clearly amused.
"Neither of you is as bad as the other one thinks," she added.
Dunn glared at Mellis. She pulled her blanket up around her shoulders and turned her back on him to face the bulkhead. Mellis looked at Lieutenant Elskid, who gave a little shrug as if to say that she'd given it a try. She looked down for a moment at her bare feet. Mellis couldn't help following her gaze. His eyes lingered a split second on her calves before resting on her red toenails.
"Well, T.S.,"
Elskid said, looking up warmly.
"Or can I call you Wino? Funny name."
Mellis felt himself blush with embarrassment because she obviously had been told all about his encounter with her roommate, and with happiness because she knew his name.
"Wino's fine," he said. "Mine's Karen. Bet you didn't know that."
"No, I didn't, Lieutenant Elskid."
"You can call me Karen when I've got a bathrobe on."
There was a pleasant, awkward pause, broken by the decidedly noisy shifting of Elskid's roommate. Mellis plunged in.
Somebody's stolen my sword.
Dunn threw back the covers from her head and turned to face Mellis. I'm sick and tired of that damn sword. Now turn your ass around and walk out of here. If it wasn't for Lieutenant Elskid, I'd have you arrested. Mellis felt his usual rage begin to uncoil, but this time he controlled it. He turned to Elskid.
I need your help.
I've gone to everyone I can think of. It's disappeared. I don't have a receipt. There's no way of tracing it. An HM-1 named Bell was the last one I saw it with. What's Lieutenant Elskid supposed to do about it, Lieutenant? Dunn said. Mellis took a deep, slow breath. He kept his eyes fixed on Elskid's. She watched him clinically.
I thought maybe you'd know how to find it, he said. If you asked around, you know, ask some of the corpsmen. Maybe they've seen it. Somebody's got to have it. Okay, I'll ask around on my shift tomorrow.
Mellis shook his head.
I can't wait. I've got orders for tomorrow.
Fear made his stomach plunge. Elskid looked at him carefully.
How much longer have you got to go?
Mellis's mind stopped.
What day is it?
Elskid laughed.
Thursday, April 3rd, unless it's after midnight. This Sunday's Easter.
Mellis was looking at his right hand and moving his fingers. 304 days and a wake-up, he finally said. It was like a life sentence. If I stay awake all night. Otherwise it's two wake-ups. He forced a smile. Her face showed kindness.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
The eye okay?
He nodded.
Legs?
He nodded again. The light in her eyes grew warmer. She looked down at her legs again. Mellis's eyes followed. Her legs were very well shaped.
Why is the sword so important?
She asked.
Somebody died.
Mellis stopped. He saw Vancouver breaking up the ambush, probably saving his life. How many lives were owed to this warrior?
I don't know. It just is.
He paused.
You had to be there.
Jesus, it's a souvenir sword, Dunn said.
She had been putting on a blue bathrobe beneath the covers. Now she got out of the berth, her body rigid beneath the robe.
It's sort of hard to explain, Mellis said.
It angered him that Dunn thought the sword was trivial, but he held it back. You'd better believe it's hard to explain, Dunn said. Her small eyes were narrowed even further. She grabbed a set of utilities and a pair of small black shoes with thick rubber soles.
Come on, Karen.
Where are you going?
Elskid asked her.
To get the duty officer.
Dunn turned her back and put her pants on underneath her bathrobe. She turned around, holding together the opening of the robe.
He hasn't done anything wrong,
Elskid said quietly but firmly.
Just off limits is all, not to mention disobedience of a direct order and disrespect for a superior officer.
Dunn sat on the bunk and pulled on a pair of khaki socks and her shoes, fumbling to hold her robe closed. She rose to her feet.
Kendra, hey, he just asked for some help. What's the big deal?
Maybe I don't like swords. Maybe I don't like him. He's off limits and way out of line.
She moved toward the hatch. Mellis put his hand on the hatch, almost as if to bar Dunn's way. His insides quivered. He tried to make his voice controlled and calm.
Please, Lieutenant, ma'am.
He held one hand out to her, palm up, finger spread, as if to ward her off.
Believe me, I didn't come here to cause trouble. I admit I'm off limits. Look, I can't explain why it's so important. Please. I just came here to ask Karen, Lieutenant Elskid, for help, and I think it's up to her. If she says no, I'll leave. I'll even leave if she says yes. I'm leaving tomorrow. I'll be out of your life. I might even be out of mine.
He turned back to Elskid and blurted out,
Karen, I've got to have that sword.
If throwing himself at Dunn's feet would have helped, he would have done it. Elskid saw this, and compassion flashed across her face. She slowly nodded. She got up and reached for her uniform.
"Go wait in the wardroom," she said to Mellis. "There's always some coffee brewing there. I'll meet you as soon as I can."
She turned to Dunn, who'd been watching them with compressed lips.
"So relax already, okay? He's harmless."
She looked back at Mellis.
"At least to us."
Mellis reached the safety of the officer's mess without incident, but his heart was still thumping. He poured himself a mug of coffee and began to wait. An hour passed. He drank two more mugs. He read magazines distractedly. Nurses and doctors filed in as the watches changed. Some nodded or said hello. The room emptied. He started on a fourth mug. Another hour passed. Then Elskid walked into the paneled room. She had the sword in her hand. Her eyes were shining and she was breathing hard, her breasts noticeably moving up and down.
"You got it!"
Mellis cried. He rushed up to hug her, then slowed and stopped. She handed it to him, almost formally, as if in a presentation. He took it.
"God, Karen, thank you."
Mellis grabbed it by the hilt and squeezed it hard, his eyes wet with triumph and gratitude. He held the sword up in front of both of them. "I feel like Sir Francis Drake," he said, suddenly self-conscious. She laughed.
"Well, if you really want to, I'll touch you on both shoulders with it. But I didn't exactly feel like Queen Elizabeth when I knocked on the hatch of the good doctor who bought it off of H.M. 1 Bell."
She laughed.
"But I was bloody fucking merry when it came to getting the deal reversed."
"I'll bet you were," Mellis said and laughed. He looked down at her and realized that she was a good 6 inches shorter than he. "It belonged to a guy in my platoon named Vancouver. He died with it, running across an LZ, trying to take out some gooks coming across from the other side. He saved the assault. He..." Mellis, to his own surprise, started to choke up. He wanted to go on, but the choking sadness filled his lungs and eyes and stopped his tongue. He couldn't speak.
"It's okay,"
Karen said. She touched him lightly on his forearm.
"He was a friend. You miss him like the others."
She gently grasped his forearm and held on. Mellis could only nod, tears streaming down his face.
"I knew it was important. You don't have to explain it. I'm glad I could find it."
She held him in her gaze and then released his arm. Mellis smiled. The chokehold was gone.
"I don't think you know what you did," he said. "Actually," she answered, "I think it's just the opposite."
Mellis looked at the sword.
"Yeah, it's like I think we're going to need it someday or something. Crazy, I guess." "No, healthy."
He looked directly into her eyes, and they looked back, clear and warm.
"I probably won't see you again," he said.
"Let's hope not." She tried to smile, but managed only a shaky twitch.
"God knows you're better off if you can stay clear of here."
She bit her lower lip.
"Will you be all right? I mean..."
She faltered.
"You know what I mean. Not physically."
Mellis nodded several times.
"I will now,"
he finally managed to say. She reached out for him and kissed him quickly on the cheek. He grabbed her with his left arm and squeezed her to him, the sword still in his right hand, caught between them. He wanted to merge with her. He tried to bury his head against her soft red hair. She pushed him away, gently but firmly. He saw that her eyes were moist as she turned and walked quickly away.
Chapter 21. The day Mellis had been medevaced, Bravo Company filed off Matterhorn and climbed back up Helicopter Hill to be evacuated.
All the holes they'd dug were taken by Delta Company and Battalion Headquarters. Fitch looked around nervously. The kids sat down. Some saw friends of theirs and went over to try to slip into their holes, but most of the company just remained exposed, lying on their backs in the wet clay. Blakely crawled out of the command bunker when the radio operator reported Bravo's arrival. He could see that there was no fight left in them. Yet he couldn't help being thrilled, remembering the assault. Blakely regretted that he couldn't have been a young lieutenant and participated in it. Yet at the same time he felt immensely proud of his own part. It was staff work, but he knew that it was important and he was good at it. Right now he had two shitty jobs to do. The first was to tell Bravo to go back down the hill. He couldn't move Delta Company because they needed to be on the LZ as the reserve and exploitation element. To leave Bravo on the hill would crowd everything and invite casualties from the mortars. Besides, if they were dug in down on the saddle, that would eliminate the NVA's easiest approaches to both hills. He watched Fitch and Hawk walk wearily toward him. Fitch's radio operator was about 3 paces behind him, shouting something at one of the troops from Delta Company.
"Lieutenant Fitch," Blakely said, reaching out to shake his hand. "I'm sorry you walked up here."
He explained that all the birds were tied up moving troops and artillery and that Bravo would have to spend the night in the saddle between Matterhorn and Helicopter Hill.
"Oh, boy," Palak said just audibly.
Blakely looked at him, a little irritated at this lack of respect.
"Sir, my men are beat," Fitch said.
"You're asking them to build another perimeter in an exposed position? We could barely keep them awake last night."
"I'm not surprised," Blakely said. It angered him that with such an unprofessional attitude, Fitch somehow always managed to come out smelling like a rose. The colonel was tickled pink over the assault. Everyone in the division, right up to the general, had been watching this one. No one had seen any of the sloppy leadership, the disrespect, sleeping on watch and getting stranded without food and water.
"Oh, boy,"
Palak said again.
"Lance Corporal Palak, that's enough," Fitch said. "Go tell Scar to get everyone water, food, and full ammunition. I'll join you later."
"Aye, aye, Skipper."
Palak looked briefly across the chasm of hierarchy and class that separated him from the major, then turned back toward what remained of the company to do his job.
"I want to talk to you two," Blakely said.
He turned and walked toward the entrance of the bunker, leaving Hawk and Fitch looking at each other.
"What's he going to do?" Fitch asked. "Make us assault the hill again?"
"He just might," Hawk answered, "with Delta defending." They followed Blakely in. Blakely said that he could have Hawk court-martialed for leaving his post.
"I guess you also know I'm not going to," he added to Hawk. "Why didn't you just come and tell me?"
Hawk was silent.
"Do you have anything to say for yourself before I dismiss you?"
"For myself? No, sir."
"Okay, then. The colonel wants to see you. He's over by Delta CP. I want to talk with Lieutenant Fitch alone."
"Aye, aye, sir." Hawk left to see Simpson. When he'd gone, Blakely told Fitch that Simpson was transferring him out of the battalion. It was only out of kindness and in recognition of his recent assault that Simpson wasn't going to relieve him of his command for cause. Fitch could consider himself transferred once they got back to VCB. Goodwin would take over until Mellis got back, and Mellis would have the company until they could get a regular. Over at Delta Company CP, Simpson said he was putting Hawk in for a Bronze Star. When Hawk rejoined Fitch and Palak next to Fitch's old bunker, he heard cries of,
"Tubing!"
People everywhere scurried into holes. The mortar rounds came crashing in. Marines huddled in their holes, holding onto their helmets, praying, trying not to think, hear, or feel. Hawk crouched low next to the bunker entrance, staring out at his old company. Fitch and Goodwin walked side by side, leading the company silently off the hill. The Marines of Bravo Company followed, in silence, giving no apparent thought to the mortar shells, walking with their rifles slung on their shoulders. Exhausted, they were as indifferent as if the falling shells were rain. Some Marines from Delta Company poked their heads up from their holes and watched their comrades, as Hawk was doing. Some shook their heads and muttered, "Crazy motherfuckers." Some let out a low whistle. Most were silent. Emotion constricted Hawk's throat. He suddenly understood why the victims of concentration camps had walked quietly to the gas chambers. In the face of horror and insanity, it was the one human thing to do. Not the noble thing. Not the heroic thing. The human thing. To live, succumbing to the insanity, was the ultimate loss of pride. The next afternoon, after the battalion staff was withdrawn, the company was ferried back to VCB. It was Sunday. Father Riordan, the battalion chaplain, thought it would be comforting to hold a memorial service. The colonel and the three readily agreed, even though regular services had already been held that morning. Goodwin had to bully everyone into going. Supply dropped off new uniforms. The company walked down to the canvas bag showers next to the stream. Unfortunately, when they washed off the dirt and crusted blood and pus, their jungle rot oozed fresh pus onto their new uniforms. Still, it was a pleasure to be able to squeeze the pus out and watch it run clean and yellow-white and soak into the clean, crisp cotton of the new jungle utilities. There was bitching, but the clean water, the new clothes, and a hot meal held it to a minimum. At 1550, Fitch and Goodwin walked over to the muddy area where the troops were pitching their shelters. "Okay, you got 10 minutes to get over to the chapel," Fitch said. "We'll see you there. After chapel, you're on your own until 0800 tomorrow." He looked around. His company was pitifully small. Then he looked down, unable to talk, his shoulders slumped. "Look, you guys," he added. He tried to smile. No words would come. His nose began to run. The muscles in his throat ached. Then he reached up and took his cap off. "Look," he croaked weakly. People rose from the ground. Those with caps on took them off and remained standing, some with hands folded in front of them, looking at Fitch standing there beneath the leaden sky. Fitch put his cap on and walked toward the chapel. At the service, Father Riordan led everyone in a hymn. Most of the blacks didn't know it, and neither did half the whites. Riordan introduced Simpson. Simpson surveyed the freshly washed young faces in front of him, feeling a stir of pride and valor. He stood with both hands behind his back, his legs slightly apart, and told them how proud he was of every one of them, how proud of those who had sacrificed everything. "It was a textbook assault, in the very best traditions of the Marine Corps." He paused, searching for words that could convey how he felt. "I don't know if you know it, but I keep a bulletin board in my quarters that has all my units listed on it. If one of my units does a particularly outstanding job, I put a gold star next to it so everyone that walks in there can see it. I've only put 2 gold stars up there the entire time I've been in country. Well, this morning I added 2 more. One for the 81mm mortars, my personal weapon of opportunity, and 1 for Bravo Company." He looked at the faces looking up at him. "There's never been a prouder commanding officer." He sat down, holding back the tears that flooded his eyes. Father Riordan stood. "Let us bow our heads in prayer." He waited for the shifting and rustling to stop. "Our Heavenly Father, we ask thee to take the souls of these departed young men who in the past several days have died for their country, giving that last greatest gift that any man can give that others might have the taste of freedom, the chance to worship thee in the way in which they..." Whispering had already started in the back of the tent. "Hey, Campuccini, you wops listen to this shit all the time? This is a fucking travesty to Jesus. Our colonel's a fucking gold star mother. Hey, Scar, can we get the fuck out of here?" "Comfort and solace to the dear ones left behind by these our departed comrades in arms. Let them know that their sacrifice was not in vain, but grant, loving Father..."
"Fucking loving Father wasn't cutting us any slack up on the hill.
I ain't angry with God, but he sure as shit must be pissed at me. Cortell, you get up there and show that mackerel how to preach, man." There were also some who said nothing, like Mole and China. The colonel retired at about midnight, thinking it had been a pretty good day. At 0200, shadowy figures crept to the downhill side of his quarters. In front, the Marine assigned as security guard fought hard against dozing off. He heard someone shout down on the mud path by the supply bunker,
"Hoo-wee, we can be so kind of fucked up."
Then another one joined in.
"Hee-yah! Shit, man!"
Laughter floated up the path. He watched two black Marines slapping hands. The guard smiled. The iron pipe caught the guard across the side of his face, caving in his jawbone and dislodging five teeth. A second one came from the other side, catching him above the eye. He sank to his knees and was hit again across the neck. His moan was stifled by a dark hand, and he was gradually lowered to the muddy ground. There was a quick flurry of activity. The two supposed drunks ran out of sight. The two pipe wielders ran in the opposite direction. Someone coolly lifted the flap of the colonel's tent and tossed in a grenade. Then he, too, ran quickly into the darkness. The clunk of the grenade on the floor startled Simpson awake. He made a muffled, frightened grunt and ran. He fell over the tent's ropes and slipped in the mud in the dark, desperately trying to beat the explosion. He dived into the mud outside, covering his head. Nothing happened. He looked up, feeling foolish in his muddy underwear. He saw his security guard slumped on the ground.
"Duty officer!"
he shouted. The heavy door of the COC bunker opened and a shaft of light spilled onto the ground before the blackout curtain closed it off. Stevens came running.
"Get a fucking corpsman!" Simpson shouted. "My guard's been bushwhacked!"
"You all right, sir?
Get a fucking corpsman!"
Stevens turned around to one of the battalion radio operators who was running up to him.
"You heard him. Get a squid."
Kid went running for the battalion aid station. Simpson was trembling.
"Someone tried to fucking frag me. I heard the grenade come in. It was a dud."
"Holy shit, sir," Stevens said. The two men stood watching the colonel's tent.
"You sure it's a dud, sir?"
Stevens finally asked, afraid the colonel would ask him to go look. Simpson stood still a moment, his muddy underwear turning cold.
"Fuck yes."
Others were coming out of the COC bunker. One had a flashlight. Then two others came running from the aid station. The corpsman also had a flashlight. Simpson took the light and walked into his quarters. Lying on the floor was a grenade with the primer taken out. Wrapped around it was a sheet of paper. Simpson took the paper off and smoothed it out. It was a mimeographed company roster with names, ranks, serial numbers, and tour rotation dates. It was Bravo Company. Names had been heavily crossed out with a ballpoint pen. Neatly typed next to them were words like murdered, crippled, maimed, blinded. Simpson crumpled the paper. Blakely burst into the room.
"You all right, sir?"
he asked.
"Yes, goddammit. A lot of good your fucking security guard did."
"He's pretty badly beat up, sir."
"He deserves it. Probably asleep. I had a fucking court-martial the puke."
He handed Blakely the grenade. "The primer's out," Blakely said. Simpson looked at him coldly.
"I'll get it in for Prince," Blakely said.
"Don't bother. You know the chances of that."
Simpson turned on the light. He handed Blakely the crumpled paper. Blakely swallowed. He handed the roster back to Simpson.
"Sir, I suggest action be taken immediately."
"What?"
Simpson asked.
"Disarm Bravo Company until we get them out in the bush again. Collect all grenades, all weapons, put extra men on guard duty. My quarters, too."
"Okay. Get Staff Sergeant Cassidy in here. They were his men. And get Lieutenant Goodwin up. It's his company."
Within half an hour, Cassidy was standing with three Marines from H&S and sadly surveying the pathetically small tent city of ponchos and prone bodies that was his old outfit. Some kids were sleeping exposed to the rain where they'd passed out drunk. Then he set his jaw.
Goodwin had refused to help him.
Okay, everybody up. Wake up in there. Everybody out of the rack.
Kids groaned. Some looked at their watches. Oh, 300. Fear struck. Somebody was in the shit so bad that they were being sent in again. The fear raced through the squalid mud.